me at midnight to talk to me about Abigail's math tutor? It was an entirely different tone of voice than the one he normally used. For years, her interaction with Nathan had reminded her of dealing with an unctuous, eager-to-please salesman working on commission only. Now that he had Abigail, he thought he was her equal. He didn't need to be apologetic anymore. He could be irritable. He could be like a regular ex-husband. "We're all asleep," he continued. "Could it seriously not have waited until tomorrow morning? Sky and Bonnie are both very light." "You're not all asleep," said Madeline. "Your 14-year-old daughter is wide awake and on the internet. Is there any supervision in that house? Do you have any idea what she's doing right now?" Madeline could hear the soft, melodious tones of Bonnie saying something sweet and understanding in the background. "I'll go check on her," said Nathan. He sounded more conciliatory now. "I thought she was asleep. And look, she wasn't getting anywhere with that math tutor. He's just a kid. I can do a better job than him. But you're right. Of course, I should have talked to you about it. I meant to talk to you about it. It just slipped my mind." "That tutor was making real progress with her," said Madeline. She and Abigail had tried out two other tutors first before they'd gotten Sebastian. The kid got such good results, he had a waiting list of students. Madeline had begged him to squeeze in Abigail. "No, he wasn't," said Nathan. "But let's talk about it when I'm not half asleep." "Fabulous. Look forward to it. Will you be letting me know of any other changes you've made to Abigail's schedule?" "Just curious." "I'm hanging up now," said Nathan. He hung up. Madeline threw her mobile phone so hard against the wall, it bounced back, landing face up on the carpet, right at her feet, so she could see the shattered screen, like the sharp reprimand of an adult to a child. Stew. "Look, I didn't think poor old Nathan was a bad bloke. I saw him a bit about the school. The place is overrun by women, and half the time they're all so busy rabbiting away to each other, it's hard to get a word in edgewise. So I'd always made a point of talking to the other dads. I remember one morning Nathan and I were having a good old natter about something when Madeline comes stalking by on her high heels, and jeez Louise, if looks could kill." Gabrielle. "I couldn't stand to live in the same suburb as my ex-husband. If our kids attended the same school, I'd probably end up murdering him. I don't know how they thought that arrangement could work. It was just crazy." Bonnie. "It was not crazy. We wanted to be as close as possible to Abigail, and then we happened to find the perfect house in the area. What's crazy about that?" Chapter 49. 5 days before the trivia night. It was Monday morning, just before the bell rang, and Jane was on her way back from the school library, where she'd returned two books Ziggy had forgotten to take back. She'd left him happily swinging along the monkey bars with the twins and Chloe. At least Madeline and Celeste weren't banning their children from playing with Ziggy. After she dropped the books off, Jane was staying on at school to help out listening to the children practice their reading. She and Lily's dad, Stu, were the Monday morning parent volunteers. As she came out of the library, she could see two of the blonde bobs standing outside the music room, very deep in important, loudly confidential conversation. She heard one of them say, "Which one is the mother?" The other one said, "She sort of flies under the radar. She's really young. Renata thought she was the nanny." "Wait, wait, I know the one. She wears her hair like this, right?" The blonde Bob pulled back her blonde locks in an exaggeratedly tight ponytail, and at that moment her eyes met Jane's and widened. She dropped her hands like a child caught misbehaving. The other woman, who was facing away from Jane, continued talking. "Yes, that's her. Well, apparently her kid, this Ziggy, has been secretly bullying poor little Amabella. I'm talking really vicious stuff." "What?" The first blonde Bob made frantic head-jerking movements. "What's wrong?" "Oh!" The woman turned her head and saw Jane. Her face turned pink. "Good morning," she said. Normally someone so high on the school parent hierarchy would smile vaguely and graciously at Jane as she walked by, a royal smile for a commoner. "Hi," said Jane. The woman was holding a clipboard up to her chest. She suddenly dropped her arm by her side so that the clipboard hung between her legs, exactly like a child hiding a stolen treat behind his back. "It's the petition," thought Jane. It wasn't just kindergarten parents signing it. They were getting parents in other years to sign it, parents who didn't even know her or Ziggy or anything about it. Jane kept walking past the women. Her hand was on the glass doors leading back out into the playground when she stopped. There was a roaring, ascending feeling in her body, like a plane taking off. It was the disdainful way that woman had used Ziggy's name. It was Saxon Banks, his breath tickling her ear. "Never had an original thought in your life, have you?" She turned. She walked back to the women and stood directly in front of them. The women took tiny steps backward, their eyes comically round. The three of them were almost exactly the same height. They were all mothers, but the blonde Bobs had husbands and houses and absolute certainty about their places in the world. "My son has never hurt anyone," said Jane. And all of a sudden, she knew it was true. He was Ziggy Chapman. He was nothing whatsoever to do with Saxon Banks. He was nothing to do with Poppy. He wasn't even anything to do with her. He was just Ziggy, and she didn't know everything about Ziggy, but she knew this. "Oh, darling, we've all been there. We sympathize. This is just a terrible situation," began the blonde Bob with the clipboard. "How much screen time do you let him have? I've found cutting down on screen time really..." "He's never hurt anyone," repeated Jane. She turned and walked away. Thea. So, the week before the trivia night, Jane accosted Trish and Fiona when they were in the middle of a private conversation. They said her behaviour was just bizarre, to the point where they even wondered if she had some mental health issues. Jane walked into the playground, feeling a strange sense of calm. Perhaps she needed to learn from Madeline's example. No more avoiding confrontation. March up to your critics and bloody well tell them what you think. A year one girl strolled alongside her. "I'm having a sausage roll for lunch today." "Lucky you," said Jane. This was one of her favourite parts of walking around the school playground, the way children chattered so artlessly, launching into whatever happened to be on their minds at the time. "I wasn't meant to be having a sausage roll because it's not Friday, but this morning my little brother got stung by a bee and he was screaming and my sister broke a glass and my mum said, 'I'm losing my mind.'" The little girl put her hands over her head to demonstrate. "And then Mum said I could buy my lunch at the canteen as a special treat, but no juice." But I could still have a gingerbread man, but not the chocolate sort. Bees die after they sting you, did you know that?
I did, said Jane. That's the very last thing they do.
Jane, Miss Barnes approached, carrying a laundry basket full of dress-up clothes. Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome, said Jane. She'd been doing this every Monday morning since the beginning of the year.
I mean, in light of, you know, everything.
Miss Barnes winced and shifted the laundry basket onto her hip. She stepped closer to Jane and lowered her voice.
I haven't heard anything else about this petition. Mrs. Lipman has been telling the parents involved that she wants it stopped. Also, she's assigned me a teacher's aide to do nothing else but observe the children, and in particular, Amabella and Ziggy.
That's great, said Jane, but I'm pretty sure the petition is still circulating. She could feel eyes on her and Miss Barnes from all corners of the playground. It felt like every parent was secretly observing their conversation. This must be what it felt like to be famous.
Miss Barnes sighed. I noticed you kept Ziggy home on Friday. I hope you're not feeling intimidated by these tactics.
Some parents are telling their children they're not allowed to play with him, said Jane.
For goodness sake.
Yeah. So I've started a petition too, said Jane. I want all those kids who won't play with Ziggy suspended.
For a moment, Miss Barnes looked horrified. Then she threw back her head and laughed.
Harper. It's all very well, the school saying they were taking the situation seriously, but then you see Jane and Miss Barnes standing in the playground laughing their heads off. To be frank, that got me riled up. That was the same morning as the assault, and yes, I am going to use the word assault.
Samantha.
Assault. Give me a break.
Chapter 50. Parent reading was done outside in the playground. Today, Jane was in Turtle Corner, named because of the giant concrete turtle sitting in the middle of a sandy play area. There was room for an adult and child to sit comfortably together on the turtle's neck, and Miss Barnes had provided two cushions and a blanket to put across their knees. Jane loved listening to the children read, watching them frown as they sounded out a word, their triumphant expressions when they untangled the syllables, their sudden bursts of laughter over the story, and their random, offbeat observations about the story. Sitting on a turtle with the sun on her face, the sand at her feet, and the sea glittering on the horizon made her feel as if she were on holiday. Piriwee Public was a magical little school, almost a dream school, and the thought of pulling Ziggy out and having to start again somewhere else without a turtle corner or a Miss Barnes filled her with regret and resentment.
Beautiful reading, Max, she said, double-checking as she did that it was indeed Max and not Josh who had just finished reading Monkey's Birthday Surprise. Madeline had told her that the trick to differentiating Celeste's boys was to look for the strawberry-shaped birthmark on Max's forehead.
I think to myself, marked Max, said Madeline.
You used great expression, Max, said Jane, although she wasn't sure that he had. The parents had been told to try to find something specific to compliment after each child read.
Yep, said Max coolly. He slid off the turtle's neck and sat down cross-legged on the sand and began digging.
Max, said Jane. Max sighed theatrically, sprang to his feet, and suddenly ran back towards his classroom, his arms and legs pumping comically, like a cartoon character running for his life. The twins both ran faster than Jane would have thought possible for five-year-olds. Jane checked his name off her list and looked up to see who Miss Barnes was sending out next. It was Amabella. Max nearly collided with her as she walked through the playground toward Jane, her curly hair lowered, her book in her hand. "Hi, Amabella," Jane called out cheerily. "Your mother and her friends are petitioning to have Ziggy suspended because they think he's hurting you, honey. So do you think you could tell me what's really going on?" She'd become fond of Amabella since she'd been doing the reading this year. She was a quiet little girl with a serious, angelic face, and it was impossible not to like her. She and Jane had had some interesting conversations about the books that they read together. Of course, she would not say a word to Amabella about what was going on with Ziggy. That would be inappropriate. That would be wrong. Of course she wouldn't. Samantha. "Don't get me wrong. I love Miss Barnes, and anyone who spends her days wrangling five-year-olds deserves a medal. But I do think letting Amabella read to Jane that day might not have been the most sensible thing in the world." Miss Barnes. "That was a mistake. I'm human. I make mistakes. It's called human error. These parents seem to think I'm a machine and they can demand a refund every time a teacher makes a mistake. And look, I don't want to say anything bad about Jane, but she was in the wrong that day too." Amabella was reading to Jane from a book about the solar system. It was the highest level book for kindergarten children, and as usual, Amabella read it fluently, with impeccable expression. The only way that Jane felt she could add any value for Amabella was by interrupting and asking her some questions raised by the book. But today Jane was finding it difficult to muster any interest in the solar system. All she could think about was Ziggy. "What do you think it would be like to live on Mars?" she said finally. Amabella lifted her head. "It would be impossible because you can't breathe the atmosphere. There's too much carbon dioxide and it's too cold." "Right," said Jane, although she'd actually have to Google it to be sure. It was possible that Amabella was already smarter than she was. "Also, it would be lonely," said Amabella after a moment. Why would a smart little girl like Amabella not say the truth? If it was Ziggy, why wouldn't she just say it? Why not tell on him? It was so strange. Children were normally such tattletales. "Sweetheart, you know I'm Ziggy's mum, right?" she asked. Amabella nodded in a duh sort of a way. "Has Ziggy been hurting you? Because if he has, I want to know about it, and I promise I will make sure he never ever does anything like that again." Amabella's eyes filled with instant tears. Her bottom lip quivered. She dropped her head. "Amabella," said Jane, "was it Ziggy?" Amabella said something Jane didn't catch. "What's that?" said Jane. It wasn't," began Amabella, but then her face crumpled. She began to cry in earnest. "It wasn't Ziggy," said Jane, filled with desperate hope. She felt an urge to shake Amabella, to demand the child just say the truth. "Is that what you said? It wasn't him?" Amabella! Amabella, sweetie!
Harper stood at the edge of the sandpit, holding a box of oranges for the canteen. She had a white scarf tied so tightly around her neck, it looked like she was being garrotted. An effect enhanced by the fact that her long, droopy face was now purpling with rage.
Whatever is the matter?
She dumped the box at her feet and walked across the sand to them.
Amabella, she said, what's going on?
It was like Jane wasn't there, or as though she were another child. Everything is fine, Harper, said Jane coldly. She put her arm around Amabella and pointed behind Harper. Your oranges are going everywhere. Turtle Corner was at the top of a small slope, and Harper's box had tipped on one side. A cascade of oranges slid down the playground toward where Stu was listening to another kindergarten child read, near the starfish wall. Harper's eyes stayed fixed on Amabella, ignoring Jane in such a pointed, deliberate way it was almost laughable, except for the fact that it was also breathtakingly rude.
Come with me, Amabella.
Harper held out her hand. Amabella sniffed. Her nose was running into her mouth in that heedless, disgusting way of five-year-olds.
I am right here, Harper, said Jane as she pulled a packet of tissues from her jacket pocket.
This was infuriating. If she'd had just another minute with Amabella, she might have been able to get some information out of her. She held the tissue over Amabella's nose.
Blow, Amabella.
Amabella obediently blew. Harper finally looked at Jane.
You have obviously been upsetting her. What have you been saying to her?
Nothing, said Jane furiously. And her guilt over her desire to shake Amabella only made her angrier still.
Why don't you go collect a few more signatures for your nasty little petition?
Harper's voice rose to a shout.
Oh, yes, good idea, and leave you here to keep bullying a defenseless little girl. Like mother, like son.
Jane stood up from the turtle and kicked at the sand with her boot, just barely managing to stop herself from kicking it in Harper's face.
Don't you dare talk about my son! Don't you kick me! Yelled Harper. I didn't kick you! Yelled back Jane, surprising herself with the volume of her voice.
What on earth? It was Stu. Dressed in his blue plumber's overalls, his hands full of the oranges he was rescuing from the playground. The little boy who'd been reading with him was standing next to him, an orange in each hand, his eyes saucer-like at the sight of two mothers yelling. At that moment there was a high-pitched yelp as Carol Quigley, hurrying back from the music room with her spray-and-wipe bottle held aloft, slipped over a stray orange and fell slapstick-style on her bottom.
Carol. I had a very badly bruised tailbone, in fact.
Chapter 51. Gabrielle. Next thing I hear, Harper is accusing Jane of assaulting her in Turtle Corner, which seems unlikely.
Stu. Harper carried on like a pork chop. She didn't look like she'd been assaulted.
I don't know. I'd just gotten a call about a blown water main. I didn't have time to deal with two mothers fighting it out in the sandpit.
Thea. And that's when some of the parents decided to report matters to the Department of Education.
Jonathan. Which obviously freaked poor Mrs. Lipman out. I think it was her birthday too. Poor woman.
Mrs. Lipman, I will say this. We couldn't possibly have suspended Ziggy Chapman. The only time he'd even been accused of bullying was at the orientation day when he wasn't even a student. After that, it was all just conjecture on the part of the parents.
I have no idea if it was my birthday. That is of no relevance.
Miss Barnes, those parents were crazy. How could we possibly have suspended Ziggy? He was a model student. No behavioural issues. I never had to put him on the sad chair. In fact, I can't even remember even giving him a red dot. And he certainly never got a yellow card, let alone a white one.
The day before the trivia night.
Madeline worked on Fridays, which meant that she mostly missed the Friday morning school assembly. Ed normally made an appearance if one of the kids was performing or receiving a merit award. Today, however, Chloe had begged Madeline to come because the kindergarten class was reciting The Dentist and the Crocodile, and Chloe had a line to say all on her own. Also, Fred's class was performing on their recorders for the first time. They were going to play Happy Birthday to You to Mrs. Lippman, which would be a painful experience for all concerned. There was a general feeling around the school that Mrs. Lippman might be turning 60, but no one could confirm or deny. Madeline had decided to go to the assembly and then work late next Monday afternoon, something she didn't used to be able to do on a Monday because she took Abigail to basketball practice while Ed took the little kids to their swimming lesson. "Abigail probably doesn't need to go to basketball training anymore," she said to Ed as they got out of the car with their takeout coffees. After they'd dropped the children off, they'd zipped down to Blue Blues, where Tom was doing a roaring trade from all the Pirrawee public parents in need of caffeine to get through a recorder performance at the assembly. Maybe Nathan is coaching her now. Ed smiled warily, probably worried she was about to launch into another rant about the cancellation of the math tutor. Her husband was a patient man, but she had noticed a glazed look on his face as she talked, admittedly for quite a long time, about Abigail's difficulty with algebra and the fact that Nathan had never been there to help Abigail with her math homework and therefore had no idea how outrageously bad she was at it. And yes, it was true that Nathan had always been good at math, but that didn't mean he could teach it, and so on and so forth. "Joy emailed this morning," said Ed as he locked the car. Joy was the editor of the local paper. "She wants me to do a piece on what's going on at the school." "What, the trivia night?" said Madeline disinterestedly. Ed often wrote short articles about school fundraising events for the local paper. She could see Perry and Celeste crossing the street to go into the school. They were holding hands, loved-up, gorgeous couple that they were, Perry walking slightly ahead, as if he were protecting Celeste from the traffic.
"No," said Ed carefully, "the bullying, the petition. Joy says bullying is one of those hot-button issues."
"You can't write about that." Madeline stopped abruptly in the middle of the road.
"Get off the road, you bloody idiot."
Ed grabbed her elbow as a car came whizzing up from the beach.
"One day I'm going to be writing a story about a tragedy on this road."
"Don't write it, Ed," said Madeline. "That's so bad for the school's reputation."
"I'm still a journalist, you know," said Ed.
It had been 3 years since Ed had given up a stressful, high-grade job with longer hours and much better pay at The Australian, so that Madeline could go back to work and the two of them could evenly share parenting duties. And he'd never once complained about the intrinsically sedate nature of work at a local paper, cheerfully going off to surf carnivals and fetes and 100-year birthday celebrations at the local nursing home. The sea air seemed to preserve its residents. This was the first time he'd ever hinted at the possibility that he wasn't entirely satisfied.
It's a valid story, said Ed.
It's not a valid story, said Madeline. You know it's not a valid story.
What's not a valid story?
G'day, Ed.
Madeline, nice to see you.
They had caught up with Perry and Celeste. Perry was in a beautifully cut suit and tie, bespoke, Italian, worth more than Ed's entire wardrobe, Madeline guessed, including the wardrobe. She managed to caress the silky fabric of his sleeve with her fingertips as Perry leaned over to kiss her and breathed in the scent of his aftershave. She wondered what it would be like to be married to a man who dressed so well. If it were Madeline, she would take such pleasure in all those lovely textures and colours, the softness of the ties, the crispness of the shirts. Of course, Celeste, who didn't have much interest in clothes, probably didn't even register the difference between Perry and rumpled, unshaven Ed, with his old, musty-smelling, olive-green fleece over his T-shirt. Watching Ed and Perry talk, though, she felt an unexpected surge of affection for Ed, even though she'd just that minute been feeling aggravated with him. It was something to do with the open, interested way he listened to Perry, and his graying, stubbled chin, in contrast with Perry's shiny, smooth jaw. Yes, she'd much rather kiss Ed. So that was lucky. Uh-oh, we're late. We dropped the boys off first at Kiss and Drop, 'cause there was no parking, said Celeste, in her flustered, worried way. The boys are so excited about Perry being here to see them perform this poem.
We're not late, said Madeline.
She wondered if Celeste had said anything to Perry yet about his cousin possibly being Ziggy's father. She would have told Ed by now.
Have you seen Jane? Asked Celeste, as if she'd read her mind.
Perry and Ed had walked ahead of them.
Have you told him?
Madeline lowered her voice and inclined her head at Perry's back.
No,
hissed Celeste. She looked almost terrified.
Anyway, Jane isn't here, said Madeline. Remember, she's got the thing with the thing?
Celeste looked blank. Madeline lowered her voice.
You know, the appointment.
Jane had sworn them to secrecy about the appointment she'd made for Ziggy to see the psychologist. If people hear I'm taking him to a psychologist, they'll think it's proof that he's doing something wrong.
Oh, yes, of course. Celeste tapped a finger to her forehead. I forgot.
Perry slowed down so that Madeline and Celeste could catch up with them.
So Ed has just been telling me about this bullying controversy, said Perry. Is this Renata Klein's daughter? The poor little girl who's being bullied?
He said to Madeline,
I sort of know Renata through work.
Really?
Said Madeline, although she already knew this from Celeste. It always seemed a safer policy not to let husbands know just how much information their wives shared.
So, should I sign this petition if Renata asks me? Asked Perry.
Madeline drew herself up, ready to go into battle for Jane, but Celeste spoke first.
Perry, she said, if you sign that petition, I will leave you.
Madeline laughed with uneasy surprise. It was obviously meant to be a joke, but there was something wrong with Celeste's delivery. She sounded perfectly serious.
That's telling you, mate, said Ed.
It sure is, smiled Perry, and he put his arm around Celeste and pressed his lips to her head.
The boss has spoken.
But Celeste still didn't smile. To all parents from your social committee. The much-anticipated Audrey and Elvis Trivia Night kicks off tomorrow in the School Assembly Hall at 7 p.m.
put your thinking caps on and be ready for a night of fun and merriment. Thank you to Year 2 Dad Brett Larson, who will be our MC for the night. Brett has been busy preparing some tricky mind benders to keep us on our toes. Fingers crossed the weather forecast will be wrong. 90% chance of rain, but hey, what do they know? And we'll be able to enjoy cocktails and canapés on our beautiful balcony before the night begins. Thank you also to all our generous local sponsors. Raffle prizes include a fab meat tray, kindly donated by our friends at the wonderful Pirui Perfect Meats. A scrumptious breakfast for two at Blue Blues. We love you, Tom. And a shampoo and blow dry at Hairway to Heaven. Wow. Remember, all money raised goes to buy smart boards for the education of our little folk. Hugs from your friendly social committee. Fiona, Grace, Edwina, Rowena, Harper, Holly and Helen. Kiss, 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 kiss. P.S. Mrs. Lipman reminds us all to be mindful of our neighbours and to keep noise levels to a minimum when we're leaving. Chapter 52. Samantha. I was watching the kindy kids do a poem at school assembly the day before the trivia night, and I noticed all the Renata supporters were on one side and all the Madeline supporters were on the other side, just like at a wedding. I had a little chuckle to myself. Pirui Public School assemblies always took far too long to start and finish, but the one thing you couldn't complain about was the location. The school assembly hall was on the second floor of the building and had a huge balcony that ran all the way along the side, with big glass sliding doors that revealed a glorious view out to sea. Right now, all the glass doors were slid open, allowing the crisp autumn air to flow through. The hall did get a bit stuffy when all the doors were closed, with all the farting children, perfumed blonde bobs, and their lavishly colognedhusbands. Madeline looked out at the view and tried to think happy thoughts. She felt ever so slightly snappy, which meant that tomorrow would be her peak day for PMS. Nobody better cross her at trivia night. "Hi, Madeline," said Bonnie. "Hi, Ed." She sat down on the empty aisle seat next to Madeline, bringing with her a nose-tickling scent of patchouli. Madeline felt Ed's hand come down and rest unobtrusively, comfortingly, on her knee. "Hi, Bonnie," said Madeline wearily, looking over her shoulder. Was this really the only empty chair in the place? "How are you?" "Very well," said Bonnie. She pulled her single plait over her white, hippie-like shoulder with its little scattering of dark moles. Even Bonnie's shoulder felt alien to Madeline. "Aren't you cold?" shivered Madeline. Bonnie was wearing a sleeveless top and yoga pants. "I just taught a Bikram yoga class," said Bonnie. "That's a sweaty one, right?" said Madeline. "You don't look sweaty." "I showered," said Bonnie, "but my core body temperature is still quite high." "You'll catch a chill," said Madeline. "No, I won't," said Bonnie. "You will," said Madeline. She could sense Ed on her left, trying not to laugh. She changed the subject while she still had the last word. "Nathan not here?" "He had to work," answered Bonnie. "I told him he probably wouldn't miss much. Skye is so terrified of performing, she'll probably hide behind the other kids." She smiled at Madeline. "Not like your Chloe." "Not like my Chloe," agreed Madeline. At
At least you can never take Chloe away from me, the way you've taken Abigail. It seemed quite outrageous to her that this stranger knew what her daughter had for breakfast this morning, and yet Madeline did not. Even though she'd known Bonnie for years now, even though they'd had 100 civil conversations, she still didn't seem like a real person. She felt like a caricature to Madeline. It was impossible to imagine her doing anything normal. Was she ever grumpy? Did she ever yell, fall about from laughing, eat too much, drink too much, call out for someone to bring her toilet paper, lose her car keys? Was she ever just a human being? Did she ever stop talking in that creepy sing-song yoga teacher voice? "I'm sorry that Nathan didn't tell you about cancelling the math tutor," said Bonnie. "Not here, you idiot. Let's not talk about family business with sharp-eared mothers all around us." "I said to Nathan, we have to get better with our communication skills," continued Bonnie. "This is all a process." "Right," said Madeline. Ed fractionally increased the pressure of his hand on her knee. Madeline looked over toward him, and to Perry and Celeste on the other side, to see if she could naturally become involved in a conversation with someone else. But Perry and Celeste were looking at something on Celeste's phone, and the two of them were laughing, their heads close together, like young dating teenagers. That strangeness between them over the signing of the petition had obviously been nothing. She looked back to the front of the hall, where there was still a hubbub of noisy activity, with kids being asked to sit down, please, and teachers fiddling with sound equipment, and the blonde bobs hurrying about looking very involved and important, as they did each Friday morning. "Abigail is really developing a social conscience," said Bonnie. "It's amazing to see. Did you know she has some sort of secret charity project she's working on?" "As long as her social conscience doesn't get in the way of school marks," said Madeline in a clipped tone, firmly establishing herself as the awful, misanthropic parent. "She wants to do physiotherapy. I've been talking to Samantha about it, Lily's mum. Samantha says Abigail needs math." "Actually, I don't think she wants to do physiotherapy anymore," said Bonnie. "She seems to be developing an interest in social work. I think she'd make a wonderful social worker."
"She'd make a terrible social worker," snapped Madeline. "She's not tough enough. She'd kill herself trying to help people, and she'd get too involved with their lives, and, oh, my God, that would just be so wrong a career choice for Abigail."
"Do you think?" said Bonnie dreamily. "Oh, well, there's no rush to make any decisions right now, is there? She'll probably change her mind a dozen times before then." Madeline could hear herself making little puffing noises through her lips, as if she were in labor. Bonnie was trying to turn Abigail into somebody that she wasn't, that she couldn't be. There would be nothing left of the real Abigail. Madeline's daughter would be a stranger to her. Mrs. Lipman walked gracefully onto the stage and stood in front of the microphone silently, her hands clasped, smiling benignly as she waited for her royal presence to be noticed. A blonde bob rushed onto the stage and did something important to the microphone before rushing off again. Meanwhile, a Year 6 teacher began clapping a catchy rhythmic beat that had magical hypnotic powers over the children, immediately causing them to stop talking, look to the front, and begin clapping in the same rhythm. It didn't work at home. Madeline had tried. "Oh," said Bonnie, as the clapping rose in volume and Mrs. Lipman lifted her hands for silence. She leaned over and spoke in Madeline's ear, her breath sweet and minty. "I nearly forgot. We'd love to have you and Ed and the children over to celebrate Abigail's 15th birthday party next Tuesday. I know Abigail would just love to have all her family together. Would that be too awkward, do you think? Awkward? Are you kidding, Bonnie? That would be wonderful, glorious. Madeline would be a guest at her daughter's 15th birthday dinner. Not the host, a guest. Nathan would offer her drinks. When they left, Abigail wouldn't come in the car with them. She'd stay there. Abigail would stay there, because that was her home. Lovely. What shall I bring? She whispered back, while she put one hand on Ed's arm and squeezed hard. It turned out that a conversation with Bonnie was just like being in labor. The pain could always get much, much worse. Chapter 53. Ziggy is a lovely little boy, said the psychologist. Very articulate and confident and kind. She smiled at Jane. He expressed concern over my health. He's the first client this week who has even noticed I have a cold. The psychologist blew her nose noisily, as if to demonstrate that she did indeed have a cold. Jane watched impatiently. She wasn't as nice as Ziggy. She couldn't care less about the psychologist's cold. So you don't think he's a secret psychotic bully, said Jane, with a little smile to show that she was sort of joking, except, of course, she wasn't. That's why they were here. That's why she was paying the huge fee. They both looked at Ziggy, who was playing in a glassed-off room adjoining the psychologist's office, where he presumably couldn't hear them. As they watched, Ziggy picked up a stuffed doll, a toy for a much younger child. Imagine if Ziggy suddenly punches the doll, thought Jane. That would be pretty conclusive. Child pretends to care about psychologist's cold and then beats up toys. But Ziggy just looked at the doll, then put it back down, not noticing that he'd missed the corner of the table and it had slid to the floor, proving only that he was pathologically messy. I don't, said the psychologist. She was silent for a moment, her nose twitching. You're going to tell me what he said, right? Said Jane. You don't have any client-patient confidentiality thing, do you? Achoo! The psychologist sneezed a massive sneeze. Bless you, said Jane impatiently. Patient confidentiality only starts to apply when they get to about 14, said the psychologist sniffily, which is just when they're telling you all sorts of stuff you'd really like to share with their parents. You know what I mean? They're having sex, they're taking drugs, and so on and so forth. Yes, yes, little people, little problems. Jane, I don't think Ziggy is a bully, said the psychologist. She steepled her fingers and touched her fingertips to the outside of her red nostrils. I brought up the incident you mentioned at the orientation day, and he was very clear that it wasn't him. I'd be very surprised if he's lying. If he's lying, then he's the most accomplished liar I've ever seen. And frankly, Ziggy does not show any of the classic signs of a bullying personality. He's not narcissistic. He most certainly demonstrates empathy and sensitivity. Tears of relief blocked Jane's nose. Unless he's a psychopath, of course, said the psychologist cheerfully. What the fuck? In which case, he could be faking empathy. Psychopaths are often very charming, but... Oh, dear, she said, wiping her nose. Thought I was getting better.
But, prompted Jane, aware that she was demonstrating no empathy whatsoever. But I don't think so, said the psychologist. I don't think he's a psychopath. I'd definitely like to see him for another appointment. Soon. I think he's suffering from a lot of anxiety. I believe there was a lot that he didn't share with me today. I wouldn't be at all surprised to learn that Ziggy himself was being bullied at school.
Ziggy, said Jane, being bullied?
She felt a rush of instant heat, as though she had a fever. Energy thrummed through her body.
I might be wrong, said the psychologist, sniffing, but I wouldn't be surprised. My guess is that it's verbal. Perhaps a smart kid has found his weak spot.
She took a tissue from the box on her desk. She made a little tch sound.
Also, Ziggy and I talked about his father.
His father? Jane reeled.
But what?
He's very anxious about his father, said the psychologist. He thinks he might be a stormtrooper, or possibly Jabba the Hutt, or, worst case scenario, the psychologist couldn't hold back a broad smile, Darth Vader.
You're not serious, said Jane. She was somewhat mortified. It was Madeline's Fred who had gotten Ziggy into Star Wars.
He's not serious.
Children often get caught halfway between reality and fantasy, said the psychologist. He's only five. Anything is possible in a five-year-old's world. He still believes in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. Why shouldn't Darth Vader be his father?
But I think it's more that he has somehow picked up the idea that his father is someone frightening and mysterious.
I thought I'd done a better job than this, said Jane.
I asked if he'd talked to you much about his father, and he said, yes, but he knows it upsets you. He was very firm with me. He didn't want me upsetting you.
She looked down at her notes and up again.
He said, be careful if you're talking to Mummy about my daddy, because she gets a funny look on her face.
Jane pressed the flat of her hand to her chest.
You okay? Said the psychologist.
Do I have a funny look on my face? Asked Jane.
A little bit, said the psychologist. She passed her a tissue. I take it Ziggy's father was not exactly a good guy?
Not exactly, said Jane.
Chapter 54. Perry drove Celeste back home after the assembly.
Do you have time to stop for a coffee? Asked Celeste.
I'd better not, said Perry. I've got that meeting at 11.
She looked at his profile. He seemed fine, his thoughts focused on the day ahead. She knew he'd enjoyed seeing his first school assembly, being one of the school dads, wearing his corporate uniform in a non-corporate world. He liked the daddy role, relished it even. Talking with Ed in that gently ironic, this is all a bit of a laugh, dad-type way. They'd all laughed at the boys careering about the stage, wearing the big green crocodile suit. Max had the head and Josh had the tail. Sometimes the crocodile seemed in danger of being torn in two as they headed in opposite directions. Before they left the school, Perry had taken a photo of the boys wearing the suit on the balcony outside the hall, the ocean in the background. Then he'd asked Ed to take a photo of all four of them, the boys peering out from underneath the costume, Perry and Celeste crouched down next to them. It would already be on Facebook. Celeste had seen him fiddling with his phone as they'd walked back to the car. What would it say? Two stars are born.
The boys rocked it as a scary croc. Something like that.
See you at the trivia night, everyone had called to one another as they'd left that day.
Yes, he was in a good mood. Things should be okay. There hadn't been any tension since he'd gotten back from his last trip. But she'd seen the lightning quick flash of rage when she'd made her comment about leaving him if he signed the petition to have Ziggy suspended. She'd meant it to sound like a joke, but she knew it hadn't come across that way, and that would have embarrassed him in front of Madeline and Ed, who he liked and admired. What had come over her? It must be the apartment. It was almost completely furnished now, and as a result, the possibility of leaving was always present. The question being constantly asked, will I or won't I? Of course I will. I must. Of course I won't. Yesterday morning, when she was there, she'd even made up the beds with fresh linen, taking a strange, soothing pleasure in the task, turning down the sheets just so, making each bed look inviting, making it possible. But then in the middle of the night, last night, she'd woken in her own bed, Perry's arm heavy across her waist, the ceiling fan turning lazily the way Perry liked it. And she'd thought suddenly of those made-up beds, and she'd been as appalled as if she'd remembered a crime. What a betrayal of her husband. She'd rented and furnished another apartment. What a crazy, secretive, malicious, and self-indulgent thing to do. Maybe threatening Perry that she'd leave him was because she wanted to confess what she'd done. She couldn't bear the burden of her secret. Of course, it was also because the thought of Perry, or anyone, signing that petition filled her with rage. But especially Perry. He owed a debt to Jane, a family debt, because of what his cousin had done. May have done, she kept reminding herself. They didn't know for sure. What if Jane had misheard the name? It could have been Stephen Banks, not Saxon Banks at all. Ziggy might be Perry's cousin's child. He owed him at least his loyalty. Jane was Celeste's friend. And even if she weren't, no 5-year-old deserved to have a community begin a witch hunt against him. Perry didn't take the car into the garage, pulling up outside the house in the driveway. Celeste assumed that meant he wasn't coming in. "I'll see you tonight," she said, leaning over to kiss him. "Actually, I need to come in to get something from my desk," said Perry. He opened the car door. She felt it then. It was like a smell, or a change in the electrical charge in the air. It was something to do with the set of his shoulders, the blank, shiny look in his eyes, and the dryness in her throat. He opened the door for her and let her in first, with a courtly gesture. "Perry," she said quickly as she turned around and he closed the door, but then he grabbed her by the hair, twisting it behind her and pulling so hard, so astonishingly hard, that pain radiated through her scalp and her eyes filled with instant, involuntary tears. "If you ever, ever embarrass me like that again, I will kill you. I will fucking kill you." He tightened his grip. "How dare you? How dare you?" He let go. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry." But she mustn't have said it right, because he stepped forward slowly and took her face in his hands the way he did when he was about to tenderly kiss her. "Not good enough," he said, and he slammed her head against the wall. The cold deliberateness of it was as shocking and surreal as the first time he'd hit her. The pain felt intensely personal, like a broken heart. The world swam as though she were drunk. She slid to the floor. She retched once, twice, but she wasn't sick. She only ever retched. She was never sick. She heard his footsteps walking away down the hallway, and she curled up on the floor, her knees near her chest, her hands interlaced over the back of her cruelly throbbing head. She thought of the boys when they hurt themselves,